Monster Tamer mumbled. He reached into a pouch on his waist and pulled out a jar that looked far too big to fit into it. That pouch was a bag of holding, a popular superior quality magic item. It could be anywhere between 10 and 50 times bigger on the inside, and items stored within would feel up to 4 times lighter than they normally were. Boxy had encountered these magic items before, but it wasn't all that interested in them. They were expensive, unshiny, and it already had access to a superior storage method. The gnome twisted open the lid of the jar and took out what appeared to be a dried piece of peach, then presented it to the strangely docile mimic. The creature immediately stretched its tongue out, snatched the tasty treat out of his hand, and happily munched on it. It let out an excited
yep,
which prompted the gnome to feed it 2 more pieces of dried fruit.
"What you folks have here is a house mimic," he declared with a smile on his face. "Quite the rare thing you found there. Not many of them left."
"So, it's not dangerous?"
asked Rowana with a bit of apprehension.
"Nah, no more dangerous than a puppy or kitty. It's not even a monster. Not in the truest sense of the word."
He lightly patted the jewelry box on the lid as it happily munched on its snacks to prove a point. The house mimic didn't shrink back or flinch this time.
"It's actually pretty cute, if you ask me."
"Yeah, guess it is."
Though Rowana was apprehensive at first, she had to admit it was strangely endearing.
"So, can we keep it?"
Kira asked with a face full of expectation.
"I don't know. How would we even care for that thing?"
"Ah, that's easy, really,"
said Jeremy.
"These buggers mostly care for themselves. They don't poop or shed, and will eat pretty much anything, so long as it's a fruit or vegetable. They'll sometimes hunt bugs, rats, or other small vermin if they get really hungry. They like hilt fruits the most. Fresh ones are best, but dried works too."
"You sure seem to know a lot about them,"
Leah pointed out.
"Truth be told, I got one of my own back home, although mine's in the shape of a cookie jar. Found it 3 years ago while looking into some missing rations. Been keeping each other company ever since. As for this little guy, seems he was a bit starved and was trying to conserve energy by hibernating."
He fed the decidedly more energetic Box a few more pieces of fruit before putting away the jar.
"So, yeah, they make for interesting pets, but they're kinda stupid. Don't expect them to learn any tricks or something, and definitely don't count on them for home security. Not only are they all cowards, but their jaws are so weak they won't even draw blood if they tried to bite a burglar. Which they won't. The most they do is make a whole lot of noise."
He then gently picked up the animate box and tickled its underside, which caused it to let out an odd purr-like noise.
"Oh, and their bottoms are sensitive, so while they like having them stroked, they'll get mad if you overdo it."
"Oh, look, sweetie. Something you two have in common,"
said Rowana with a coy smile.
"Rowie!" "Sweet Nairi, not this again,"
Leah grumbled, exasperated.
"So, yeah, if you guys don't want to keep it, I'll gladly take it off your hands,"
offered Jeremy, who graciously ignored the couple's exchange.
"We'll keep it. Definitely keeping it. Right, Rowie?"
Kira enthusiastically asked.
"Jeremy, can you promise me it's safe?"
"I swear on my life, Miss Slythe."
"Okay, then. I'll trust your judgment on this."
"All right! Thanks, Rowie! You're the best!"
Following Kira's excitable character, Boxy threw its arms around the elf and gave her a wet smack on the lips. This was much to Leah's discomfort and Jeremy's shock.
"Kira!"
Rowana pushed the catgirl off.
Sorry. I got carried away. So, Jeremy, please don't... I mean...
"Fret not, Miss Slythe. I'm a professional, and what happens in this room is strictly confidential. Besides, I'm not in the business of spreading salacious rumors."
"Thanks."
"Anyway, I suggest you folks get the little guy tagged and have him registered. You can do both of those at my guild's office."
Mr. Rizzlecrank, can you recommend some books on mimics, or just shapeshifters in general?"
"Oh-ho! Good attitude, Miss Morgana. Knowing everything about one's pet is rather crucial if you want to take care of them, especially in the case of magical critters like your square pal here."
Well, that wasn't actually the reason Boxy asked for those. If anything, it was already an expert on the matter of mimics. It's just that it wanted to know what the world at large knew about its kind, lest it reveal too much information in the future.
Check the library for Volume 3 of Riften's Monster Encyclopedia. It should have the info you need. Word of warning, though, there's some dark history attached to the whole mimic thing, the gnome added.
Okay, thanks.
Sure thing. Do drop by if you have any more questions. I'll answer them free of charge, of course.
We'll take you up on that offer when the time comes,
said Ruana with a businesslike smile. The former mimic picked up its smaller cousin, and the three girls parted ways with the gnome.
So, what are you guys going to call it?
Leah asked on the way to get it registered.
How about Goldie?
Ruana suggested.
I don't know, that's a little common.
The other elf shrugged.
Shiny? That's just puerile, Ruana. Maybe. Oh, I know. Red Eye. What? After the gym and its lid? Is that real, by the way? I don't know, but it's rather pretty. Anyway, Red Eye isn't bad, but it makes it sound a lot more vicious than it appears. Mimic,
Kira confidently declared.
I'm sorry?
Leah asked dumbly.
It's a mini mimic, so I'm gonna call it Mimic. That? I'm not sure if that's genius or idiotic.
The younger elf shook her head.
I think Mimic sounds cute. Let's go with that,
offered the older one. The cat girl held the living jewelry box up above her head and gave it a wide smile.
Pleasure to meet you, Mimic.
Yep, yep.
The house mimic had perked up considerably after its meal. It let out a few high-pitched, almost bark-like sounds in response. Its soon-to-be owners took it into the Children of the Wild's office and, with Jeremy's assistance, made its name official. A scribe performed some kind of naming ceremony, engraving the critter's name onto its status. She then gave the couple a set of tags on a string meant to identify their pet's owner as Kira Morgana. The girls thanked the clerk and then dropped by the library to check out the book their gnomish consultant had suggested. Eager to learn more, they all gathered around a table inside and looked up the entry on house mimics. According to Volume 3 of Riften's Monster Encyclopedia, house mimics were the original mimics, predating their more violent dungeon-born counterparts by several decades. House mimics had apparently been created roughly 4.5 centuries ago by Ivran Tol-Seroth, one of the greatest scholars to have ever lived. An exceptionally gifted enchanter, alchemist, druid, and warlock, he had used some unknown combination of eldritch and natural magic to breathe life into his furniture. A man of extreme solitude, he had created hundreds of house mimics to be his companions, assistants, and servants. These critters had been born of good intentions and were innocent in their purpose. In fact, they had a powerful aversion to violence that prevented them from ever harming another sentient being, barring the occasional annoying vermin. Though that gnome called them cowards, it was far more accurate to say they were hardcore pacifists, creatures that would not attack another even if their lives depended on it. They were so far removed from the dungeon mimics of today that both Kira and Leah couldn't help but start digging around the library to figure out how those violent boxes had come into existence. That was how and why they learned of the dark history Jeremy had warned them about. The Elven Dominion, the Ishigar Republic's predecessor at the time of Tol-Seroth, had been to blame for the violent deviation of house mimics. Apparently, Queen Vasya the Last had made the phenomenal mistake of ordering the Great Sage to assist in her country's fight against the then-fledgling Lodrak Empire. This was a demand Tol-Seroth had refused outright. He had been an old and feeble man at the time, and had decided that spending his twilight years in peace and comfort was more important than appeasing the whims of some pompous monarch. The Queen had not taken this response lightly, and had retaliated by unleashing the power of a phantasmal-grade magic item known as the Authority of the Crown. This immensely powerful, orb-shaped relic had been passed down from one member of the royal bloodline to the next. It bestowed upon its royal wielder ultimate power over any citizen of the Dominion. Queen Vasya had used this arcane relic to place a gesh on Tol-Seroth that compelled him to obey her commands. His free will stripped away, The once great sage had been reduced to a mindless drone that slaved away to turn his peace-loving pets into tools of war. Dubbing them war mimics, the old man had apparently been terrible at naming things, these alchemically engineered monstrosities were designed to be merciless killing machines that craved human flesh. The thoughtless creatures would hibernate for extended periods of time, during which they would have the appearance of sturdy yet plain furniture. The Elf Queen's spies would then smuggle these dormant killers into Imperial settlements. Once they had awoken from their slumbers, these war mimics would indiscriminately kill civilians. They had apparently been such formidable fighters, a single one reportedly caused casualties in the hundreds, sometimes thousands, before they were finally killed or driven off. The whole thing had been a heartless campaign of terror that the Queen hoped would crush the Empire's will to fight. This clearly did not pan out as she had hoped, for the regent did not go down in history as Queen Vasya the Last without reason. Unbeknownst to her, Tol Saroth had worked within the confines of his Gesh to sabotage the power-mad tyrant, much like a resentful familiar that had an easily misinterpreted order. In her arrogance, Queen Vasya had used the authority of the crown to command Tol Saroth to assist her in wiping out the enemies of the elven people. The ruler had failed to consider that the great sage wholeheartedly believed the biggest threat to his people's well-being had been the Dominion itself. This had allowed him to work behind the scenes to quietly replace the vast majority of the royal palace's furniture with camouflaged war mimics. Hundreds of these creatures had woken up almost simultaneously one evening, resulting in the total annihilation of the royal bloodline, along with their advisors, retainers, concubines, and elite guard. It was not known what had become of the authority of the crown, as the phantasmal relic had disappeared seemingly without a trace during the fall of the palace. The power vacuum left in the wake of Tol Saroth's vengeance eventually led to the authoritarian monarchy's total collapse. The once great sage had, for better or for worse, not survived to see this happen. Numerous historical accounts state that, on the eve of the mimic-assisted coup, he had caused a devastating explosion that had gone down in history as the Calamity of Tol Saroth. The blast had scarred the land and poisoned the air in a manner eerily similar to what Boxy had done at Mon Atal, though on a smaller scale. The original calamity had resulted in the total obliteration of Tol Saroth's war mimic breeding facility, his research on the subject, and, depressingly enough, the great sage himself. As for the war mimics left in his wake, they had continued to terrorize the countryside of both the Empire and the crumbling Dominion. Though this hadn't lasted long. While superbly durable and deadly, war mimics had shockingly low lifespans. This, combined with their inability to reproduce, led to the species going completely extinct within a few years. It was a widely held belief by the modern academic community that these flaws were intentional rather than accidental. Tol Saroth had gone down in history as a man possessing both a brilliant mind and inscrutable morals. A person whose life's work had been focused on the betterment of society as a whole, never at the expense of an individual's life or personal freedom. It was not a tremendous leap of logic to assume that such a person had added planned obsolescence to the living weapons he had been forced to create. It certainly hadn't been accidental, as many of his original mimics were still alive to this day, over 4 centuries later. Yet, despite Tol Saroth's measures and precautions, dungeon-born mimics like Boxy still existed. Its particular subspecies began to appear in the decades following the sage's death. Officially known as lesser and greater mimics, their kind seemed to be a halfway point between the docile house mimics and the relentlessly savage war mimics. Though the exact reasons behind this turn of events remained a mystery to this day, none could argue that the world would be a better place without this lasting mockery of a great man's legacy. Leah closed the book in front of her with a glum expression, while Kira and Rowana looked on in disbelief. This simple, curious inquiry into Minnick's origins had brought to light a somewhat obscure but nevertheless tragic piece of history. One could argue they could have quit while they were ahead. But a certain shapeshifter's insistence had them see this inquiry to its bitter end. Admittedly, the story was full of holes, speculation, and assumptions, but it also was a miracle that even this much had survived those turbulent times,
Our ancestors did some terrible things.
The elf ranger sighed.
This is unbelievable. Are we sure these books are accurate?
Rowana asked with desperate hope that this had all been a big lie.
Please don't even suggest that. This library is normally exclusive to members of the consortium.
Leah frowned.
Adventurers live and die based on the accuracy of information they receive, so I have no doubt these materials are genuine. There's even some books here that are not publicly available and require special authorization to access, likely due to the sensitive information they hold. The humans are not entirely blameless either,
Kira interjected.
If not for their warlike attitude, none of that would have happened.
Those were just empty words to move the conversation along. As the one who was the most concerned with these revelations, Boxy didn't know what to think. Learning about its origins was harder to stomach than it had expected. It suddenly made sense why it craved human flesh. Granted, it would not turn down the odd elf or dwarf, but humanity was the ultimate delicacy, the race it wanted to devour the most. This was also probably the reason Leah smelled tastier than other elves, as she had stated that her mother was born of a human father and an elf mother. Although the resulting children of such couplings were always the same race as the mother, they still carried some of the father's genes and traits. Boxy's preferences were so pronounced that it could quite literally smell the traces of humanity that were passed down to Leah from her grandfather. Honestly, the idea that some ancient elf was the source of its instincts was more than a little infuriating. Having grown up in a dungeon, the then-mimic had sworn to itself that it would not let anything or anyone control it like that ever again. As it turned out, it had been influenced by some long-dead, pointy-eared asshole from hundreds of years ago this whole time. Minik, who sat idly on the table the entire time, was apparently a remnant of Tol Saroth's original legacy. Boxy had the sudden urge to crush this creature there and then. But that whim subsided almost as quickly as it came. This creature wasn't to blame. If anything, it was a victim. The wannabe cat girl stretched its hands out and hugged the small creature. Not to restrain it, as it had done initially, but out of some bizarre feeling bordering empathy. Rowana embraced her solemn-looking girlfriend from the side in an effort to comfort her. Leah had the same intention, though she felt awkward about touching the couple and instead stroked Minik's lid.
Those poor creatures,
Rowana mumbled.
Mimics, I mean. Bred to know nothing but violence and made to kill others until they expire. I can't even imagine what horrible fate had— Rowana, don't get the wrong idea,
Leah interrupted her.
Mimics are monsters. Regardless of their origins, they are vile, vicious, and delight in the suffering of elves and humans alike. They have no loyalty, no compassion, and would not hesitate to eat you on sight without a single shred of remorse. Do not spare them any pity. They're not worth it. I see. Yes, you're right. If you're still going to feel bad about any of them, then be sure to make yourself feel better by spoiling this little guy rotten. Yeah. Thanks, Leah,
Kira said in a low voice.
I really needed to hear that.
These were Boxy's honest feelings. Although her words were meant to be a cautionary speech for Rowana not to ever feel sympathy for a monster, they also became a surprisingly effective pep talk for the doppelganger. Boxy realized that it didn't need to doubt itself or try to change its homicidal ways. It knew who and what it was, and it wasn't going to let some centuries-old story change that. Besides, it was now intelligent enough to suppress any and all instincts that Tol Saroth fellow had given it and its predecessors. Therefore, rather than feel conflicted about its past, it chose to focus on its future and redouble its efforts in the acquisition of both tasty and shiny things.
Come on, let's get out of here,
it offered, and the other two agreed. The three of them returned all the books they had borrowed to their shelves and went their separate ways. The couple's day out on the town had taken an unexpected turn, but it was hardly the waste of time Boxy had expected it to be. There had been one more point of interest in Tol Saroth's story. It was a piece of trivia the shapeshifter was quite surprised to learn, but one that made sense in retrospect. That elf had had many jobs, but the main one had been that of a warlock. Although his exact levels had been lost to history, his biography stated that he was known for having 3 different familiars under his command, a clear sign of a nearly maxed-out demonology skill. This meant the warlock magic, stated in the history books, likely referred to the reality-warping energies of the beyond. In other words, all mimics, Boxy included, likely had a quasi-demonic origin. Perhaps that had been why it got along with its contracted familiars so well, and also why the Goddess of Impossibilities had such an interest in the creature. That hadn't been the surprising thing, though. The tidbit that piqued Boxy's interest had been the recorded descriptions of the ancient elf's demonic familiars. Although their names weren't known, their appearances and actions were. The first two had been a beholder and a fiend, which he had used as a research assistant and bodyguard, respectively. They were ultimately unimportant, as it was the third and final one that caught Boxy's attention. She was described as a succubus with the expected nubile proportions, one that had light blue skin, glowing pink eyes, waist-long hair the color of the night sky, 2 golden curved horns on either side of her head, and a pair of large, red, bat-like wings sprouting from her back. These traits were typical for thousands of cerulean succubi, and if it was just for these, Boxy would not have given this matter a second thought. However, it couldn't help but notice the accounts of this particular demon's exploits suggested she had a manic tendency for burning things to the ground whenever the opportunity presented itself. Part 3.
Oh, yeah. There was a guy who had furniture like that, exclaimed Zira.
Really? That's all you can say about him?
Asked Boxy.
Forgive me, Master. It's just that I really did not care about my masters before I met you, so they all sort of blurred together.
The succubus had a point. Typically speaking, demons didn't exactly hold mortals in high regard. Even if she was contracted to Tulsaroth, it didn't mean she paid much attention to the man.
Can you at least tell me what he was like?
Let's see. He was insane, the boring kind. He would obsess over one project or another and lock himself in his workshop. He'd usually leave us familiars in the beyond and only call us out to guard the house and look after his pets. He was also super gay. Never got so much as a semi, no matter how many times I thrust my breasts in his face or sensually caressed his back.
What about after the Dominion got in his head and forced him to breed living weapons?
Did that happen?
You tell me.
He did move to some gloomy megatower or something with a whole bunch of other old, boring, scholarly types. I really didn't pay much attention, but it was fun to see him rip his hair out from all the stress and frustration. It was fun up until he detonated that dungeon core he was experimenting on.
So, it would seem this was what Snack had alluded to when she said she knew what a catastrophic meltdown was all those months ago.
What about the creation of mimics?
No idea, Master. Like I said, he did all his research and experiments cooped up in his lab. All I know is his furniture suddenly started moving around and trying to bite me at some point.
And your personal opinion on him?
Well, I suppose he knew how to ruin someone's day with ruin magic. That was fun to watch. I think he's also where I picked up my staff twirling habits from, actually. They don't really do anything, but they're kind of fun. Huh. I guess he wasn't too bad a master, all things considered. Not nearly as great as you, though.
I see.
Her words weren't particularly helpful or insightful, but they were somewhat informative. The only reason the doppelganger questioned her about its ancestor's creator was out of curiosity rather than necessity. So this much was enough.
I'll be coming by the dungeon later. Stand by the core until then.
Understood, Master.
Boxy cut off the telepathic communication and walked out of the restroom.
All done, Kira?
Asked Ruana with an idle smile.
Yep.
The shapeshifter had found out the hard way just how difficult it was to maintain its cover while talking to its minions, Ambrosia included. Splitting its attention between physical and mental conversations was difficult. so it decided it was better to excuse itself for a while rather than space out in the middle of a conversation.
"Where's Leah?"
it asked, while looking around.
"Oh, she said she had to run. Something about helping her father in the inn."
"Oh, right. She did say she wasn't going to stick around long. How's Minnick?"
"Hugging it like this is a bit uncomfortable, but the little guy seems happy enough, so I don't mind."
The mini-mimic gave a small, happy-sounding yelp from in between the elf's arms. She held it against her well-shaped breasts as if it were a precious book, and the tiny creature seemed to thoroughly enjoy the soft sensation pressing against its underside. Boxy's own undercarriage had been relatively sensitive during its mimic days, so it understood where Minnick was coming from. It also made a mental note to get the little guy a soft pillow to sit on in the future. A cheap one.
"Well, I think that's enough excitement for one day. Shall we get home, sweetie?"
offered Rolana.
"Sure,"
Kira agreed. The two of them proceeded to walk down the road while chatting away happily about inconsequential stuff. Boxy just smiled and nodded for the most part. It realized that Kira really did not have any hobbies beyond being a ranger, which was perhaps a flaw in her character. It was common for adventurers to pick up a secondary job, typically a craft-focused one that synergized with their combat-oriented profession. Perhaps this was a good opportunity to make Kira's artificer job public. Actually, no. It was still too early for that. Fayhorn told all his students to put off on acquiring a second job until they surpassed level 25 of their ranger job. After that, he recommended they look into alchemist, rogue, or monster tamer, as those had high compatibility with the bow-wielding ranger. It made Boxy giggle a bit on the inside. A monster with the monster tamer job sounded so ironic that it almost wanted to give that a try for the fun of it. That would be a waste of time, though, as the former mimic's ability and willingness to look after living creatures was quite non-existent. Besides, Kira would definitely go after the artificer job when the time came, and would be aided by a very capable teacher she happened to meet and become friends with after a certain joint training lesson. Speaking of which, Boxy considered it had to be very careful in regards to what jobs it got in the future. This wariness stemmed from something it learned quite recently as part of its adventuring studies. Namely, the unwritten rule that an individual could only hold a limited number of jobs at any time. This number seemed to vary between various races. Elves, for example, could have as many as 8, while dwarves and gnomes were a bit lower at 7. Humans, on the other hand, could get all the way up to 10, and beastkin were limited to 6. It was normally hard to find a person who held more than 4 or 5 different jobs, so it wasn't much of an issue for most people. It was, however, an issue for Boxy. The consortium's library had no information regarding the maximum number of jobs a monster could possess, but records showed appraisals of creatures that had at least as many as humans. After all, a monster could rank up many times during its lifespan, and every new rank up could come with a new job. It seemed logical that they would have more job slots available every time they evolved into a different species. The takeaway from that was that each creature had a hard job limit. Even if Boxy didn't presently know its own cap, that still meant the garbage tier cat job was taking up a valuable slot. Both the attribute bonuses of this job and the effects of its single skill, feline agility, were extremely lackluster. It was also impossible to advance beyond level 5, likely because Boxy was not of a feline species. Boxy had already looked into whether a scribe could clean up its status, but that seemed impossible. The monster would need to find someone who was both capable of appraising cat job and wouldn't ask questions about how an adventurer would have such a thing. It was also out of the question to try and learn the scribe job for itself because doing so involved subjecting itself to regular anti-shapeshifter shock tests as a precaution against doppelgangers. Additionally, judging from what it had heard about it, trying to level up the scribe job was a maddeningly slow and boring process. Therefore, Boxy was stuck with being part cat, at least for the time being. It would need to be very careful regarding job acquisition in the future, lest it accidentally ruin its chances at ranking up into an even more powerful species. The shapeshifter had also been more selective with its cadaver absorption targets, as it was wary of being stranded with another subpar job.
Kira, you're spacing out again.
Oh, sorry, Roey. I was just thinking about the future,
the redhead replied.
Our future.
Oh my. I'm flattered, but I think it's a bit too early to be thinking about
Just then, someone bumped into Rowana with a lot of force in a move that Boxy realized was clearly on purpose. It deftly moved as Kira to catch the platinum blonde elf before she hit the ground. The man that knocked her over just kept running away at a dead sprint.
Hey, watch it, pal!
Kira yelled after him, before turning her attention back to Rowana.
Huh? Wait, where's Minik? I must have dropped him in the... Oh, no! That guy stole him!
Oh, it's the fabled hit-and-run pickpocket,
Boxy exclaimed internally.
So that's how that works, eh?
The monster was rather impressed with the thief's technique. It was almost a shame that the stupid piece of meat thought that it could steal one of Boxy Team Morningwood's belongings.
Wait here. Kira?
Rowana stared up at her girlfriend, slightly taken aback by the cold hatred in her voice and eyes. Boxy noticed her reaction and realized that its animosity had momentarily slipped through its facade, prompting it to try and cover up for the mistake.
Look, I'm sorry. I have to go get it back. I won't let anyone take something precious from me ever again.
There was more truth in those words than Boxy intended, but they had the right effect.
Okay.
The elf stammered.
I get it. Just go. And be careful. I always am.
The woman felt a bit relieved when she saw the same reassuring smile Kira always gave her, and watched the beastkin take off into the crowd on all fours. Having somehow salvaged the situation, Boxy turned its attention towards the cloaked figure that attempted to rob it. It had already moved beyond its magical perception range and blended into the crowd, but it wasn't a problem. The apprentice ranger already had the scent of its target, and the tracking skill highlighted the man's trail, illuminating his footprints in a soft glow that only Boxy could see. The beastkin ran through the crowds with reckless abandon as per usual, going in between legs, through stalls and over carts. Eventually, she turned into a side alley, which had some old crates and jars strewn about.
Shit! What the fuck is this?
An agitated voice came from behind a pile of trash. A squeaky voice protested in response. It would appear the thief had just realized that the expensive-looking, ornate jewelry box he had stolen was, in fact, a living being.
Ah, whatever. That jewel should be worth something at least.
He reached behind his belt and took out a small knife, clearly intending to carve the expensive-looking thing out of the struggling house mimic.
Hands off, asshole!
The still-in-character catgirl ran up to him while he was distracted and slashed his forearm with her retractable claws.
What the fuck?
It didn't do a lot of damage, and the cut was rather shallow, but it still caused the hooded elf to stagger backwards and drop the panicking box. Having obtained its freedom, Minik quickly ran away from the scary person and hid behind its far more ferocious cousin.
You got some nerve trying to steal other people's pets!
Kira accused the man.
You'll regret that, you little tramp!
The man swung at the cat girl with more speed than she was expecting. Judging from his movements, he must have been around a level 30 or 35 job holder. Most likely a rogue, which was unsurprisingly common among pickpockets, thieves, burglars, and other ne'er-do-wells. He was hardly a threat to a monster of Boxy's caliber, but the shapeshifter was currently undercover. Objectively speaking, there was no way a level 14 ranger would be able to defeat a level 30-something rogue in close quarters, especially when the former was an unarmed teenager and the latter was an adult male holding a rather big knife. Of course, none of that would matter so long as the beastkin hadn't been the one to fight this hoodlum. A shadowy figure suddenly dropped down in the path of the advancing rogue, hiding Kira from the thug's view. The interloper's long, flowing cloak obscured his body and a face wrap concealed his face and head. He appeared to be a man with naturally wide shoulders and slightly over 2 meters in height. Armored boots skidded across the ground, and a pair of metal-clad hands burst out of the billowing garment, grabbing hold of the startled thief's arm and collar. The stranger then slammed the elf against the nearby wall and pressed the edge of his own blade against the thief's throat. The poor sod looked into his attacker's unnaturally yellow eyes, which seemed to glow from inside his mask. The street thug proceeded to liberally soil his undergarments as a wave of terror unlike anything he had ever experienced washed over his entire being. The much larger man let out a disjointed, inhuman laugh that sounded like an entire pack of hyenas choking to death.
"What's going on here?"
A loud, commanding voice came in from the entrance to the alley. A group of 8 people approached in matching silver-plated armor with an eagle wing motif decorating their shoulder plates and helmets. They were part of Azurevale's city guard, most likely a patrol that had come to investigate who could be raising such a ruckus in this dingy little alley. The cloaked figure threw a glance at them over his shoulder, then clambered up the side of the building and disappeared over the rooftops in a formidable display of agility. As for the rogue, he was left behind, curled up on the ground. Well, most of him, anyway.
My arm!
He screamed and roared as blood flowed out of the stump on his right hand, which was ripped clean off his wrist when his assailant retreated.
Medic! Quickly!
The man in the fanciest-looking helmet bellowed orders.
Jammy! Watch the girl! The rest of you, up those rooftops!
The patrol flew into a frenzy as they complied. The leader and medic attended to the wounded thief, while a third one told Kira to sit by and not make any sudden moves. The other 5 deftly clambered up the walls, despite their heavy-looking armor. They returned a few minutes later, carrying only the stranger's discarded cloak and mask, claiming he vanished into thin air just when they thought they had caught up to him. The would-be thief, the cat girl, and her pet box with teeth were then taken into custody and questioned. Kira merely told the truth. She was walking home with her roommate when that guy tried to rob them. She chased after him using her natural agility and ranger skills, then foolishly confronted him in the alley. She then realized she was outmatched and would have been stabbed for sure if that mysterious fellow hadn't intervened.
So, you did not know the supposed thief?
The guard continued interrogating her.
No, I've never seen him before in my life.
All right. What about the man who intervened?
Same. He just dropped in out of nowhere. If it wasn't for him...
The shapeshifter pretended to regret its own recklessness, hence why Kira made that "it's all my fault" face while looking at the ground.
Indeed. You're lucky he showed up. Otherwise, you could have been seriously hurt.
I know. Do you have any idea who that was?
None of your business, miss.
Please? I just want to know who I have to thank for saving me from my own stupidity.
The adorable catgirl's sincere demeanor made the soldier's eyes swim for a bit. The effects of Boxy's unseen charisma attribute coupled with its attractive outward appearance meant that it was easy to lull people into a false sense of security with the right attitude. This, again, was something that Snack had demonstrated many times over the past month or so.
Look, officially we're told not to deny his existence, said the guard in a hushed tone. But I think that was the Sandman from the rumors.
Wait, he's real?
Shh. Keep your voice down, girl.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Anyway, yeah, he's real. They say he's been dismantling gangs and cartels throughout the city, but it also seems he's not above stomping a few street thugs along the way.
But?
She asked pointedly.
But he's still a criminal. There's no telling how many innocents were caught up in his... business, so I urge you to stay away from him.
I see. Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Thanks a lot for sharing this with me, Mr. Guard.
Kira flashed a radiant smile reminiscent of a sunflower in full bloom. It made the middle-aged elf cough lightly with embarrassment. The catgirl in front of him was so adorable that he found himself wanting to hug her, pat her head, and scratch her fuzzy ears, though not in a lecherous way. She just seemed like the sort of cute daughter that any father would be proud of. However, the guard recognized such behavior as inappropriate and unbecoming of an older man, especially a public servant and peacekeeper.
You're welcome, Missy. Just keep it between us, okay? My boss will yell at me if he learned I went around saying stuff like that. What I said was just hearsay and speculation. Nothing more.
You got it, Mr. Guard. It'll be our little secret.
She gave the guard a small wink with a finger against her thin lips, making him almost unable to bear it. This girl was downright dangerous, almost as if someone had tried to weaponize cuteness itself. Which was more or less the case. As for the guard's guess regarding the Beastkin's savior, he had been only partially correct. That particular Sandman had been a mirror image prepared by Boxy. The shapeshifter had noticed the armed patrol and their shiny armor just before it had followed the thief into the alleyway. It seemed likely they would interfere, so it chose to remain in character while letting its body double take all the credit for thwarting the theft. Not only did this divert attention and suspicion away from Kira, but it was also the first time that the rumored vigilante had left so many witnesses behind. Even if the office of the city guard wanted to keep the Sandman's existence under wraps, they would be unable to stop so many people from blabbing about him now. Then, once Boxy's darker alter ego had obtained a certain amount of notoriety and reputation, it would offer its services to the right people. Preferably those with few scruples, lots of money, and a good amount of influence. It was only natural there would be some government official or affluent individual who required something taken care of quickly and quietly. For a nominal fee, of course. The shapeshifter had no issue providing its services to the highest bidder, but it had to build up the Sandman as a meticulous and brutally efficient professional. With the interview over, the guard escorted Kira out of the building. Ruana had been patiently waiting for her in the lobby with Minik, both of whom seemed relieved she was all right. The elf scolded her a bit for being reckless, while the animate box excitedly bumped against her ankles. It would appear that, even though it had the intelligence of a rusty doorknob, the house mimic understood that the redhead had saved it from a dangerous situation. Congratulations! You are now a level 14 doppelganger. All attributes plus 2. Boxy cheered internally at the level up as the couple and their new pet proceeded happily towards their love nest. They got home without further incident, had a modest dinner of vegetable soup and performed their nightly dose of lovemaking and cuddling before Ruana fell asleep in Kira's arms. The catgirl waited a bit to make sure she was completely out of it, before wriggling out of bed and exchanging places with Zira through use of the trans-familiar spell. The succubus would keep an eye on Ruana and make sure she didn't wake up and notice Kira's absence. Zira was under orders to only use the sleep spell and to avoid activating the Dreamweaver skill unless absolutely necessary. Repeated use of the skill made it unreliable, and Boxy didn't want a repeat of what had happened with Fizzy prior to their capture by Edward, the Empire's spymaster.
"'Tis good to see thee again, my lord."
Upon returning to the dungeon, Ambrosia greeted Boxy with an overjoyed smile.
"Yeah, it's good to be back,"
it replied as it transformed from its true doppelganger shape into a spider-legged chest. Boxy still wasn't sure why or how, but the transfamiliar spell forcefully undid its shapeshifting. If other teleportation-type spells had the same effect, then that might prove to be a big problem, especially since the people of the Republic relied on those gigantic circular forest gates to transport goods and people across large distances in an instant. It was highly likely that Boxy would need to use them at some point. The fact that the use of those gates was strictly regulated and supervised meant it couldn't just test it out at its leisure, either. Then again, the transfamiliar spell supposedly functioned using different principles from standard spatial magic, so it was likely this shape-shifting thing was a quirk unique to that particular incantation. Putting its worries aside for the moment, the box began inspecting the workshop that Fizzy had set up with the dungeon core's functions. A large, rectangular room had been carved into the side of the tree's inner wall through terrain sculpting and was easily accessible from the platform where the dungeon core resided. It had only three walls, meaning there was no doorway or anything to separate the workshop from the rest of the open space. Inside was a large stone furnace, as well as three anvils of different make and material. A myriad of tools lined the walls alongside a plethora of shelves, boxes, and display cases. These containers stood vacant, ready to be filled with all kinds of components, parts, and mechanisms. There was also a long wooden table attached to the left wall, opposite the furnace. This would probably serve as Fizzy's workstation. In fact, she seemed to have already started working on something if the lump of casings, screws, and wires on the table was any indication.
Was all of this made through item allocation and terrain sculpting?
'Tis so, milord. These tools and facilities were created and maintained through the core, although they require a small amount of upkeep to keep them operational.
Hmm. I suppose that much is fine, then. What about using dungeon-created materials to level up the job? Did Fizzy try that?
Indeed she did, milord. Unfortunately, it did not seem to be sufficient. 'Tis the reason she is currently away procuring materials at this time.
Well, that was to be expected.
Temporary things born of pure mana did not provide a permanent boost to one's job or skill levels. It was an unwritten rule of this world. Using magically created tools was probably okay, though, just so long as the materials used came from outside the dungeon.
Oh, that reminds me. I have some more good news regarding Milady Fizzy's position, milord.
Ambrosia declared enthusiastically.
Thine servant hath discovered the dungeon is capable of creating a bracelet of allegiance, a magical item that identifies anyone who wears it as a friend to the dungeon. I hath taken the liberty of preparing one for Milady Fizzy upon her return.
The dryad pointed towards a small pedestal that stood just outside the magically created artificer workshop. On it was a thin steel bangle with a tiny, glowing gem embedded into it. Boxy couldn't help but notice that this precious stone looked a lot like a miniature version of the dungeon core. Unfortunately, as shiny as it was, this thing would most likely vanish into thin air if it were taken outside the dungeon's sphere of influence. On the upside, if what Ambrosia said was true, then the Dryad's domain would finally stop treating Fizzy as a hostile invader.
I see. Very convenient, the shapeshifter declared sagely. Hmm? Where's Arms?
Thy many-limbed servant is currently assisting this one,
the tree spirit informed it.
I have found a new nest of pests that hath burrowed themselves into mine bark, and she is currently evicting them.
These pests are termites and not elves, right?
Of course, milord. This one would rather not harm the favored of Nairi if it could be avoided. They are responsible for carrying this one's fruits and seeds throughout the land and raising mine offspring in safety. In return, I provide them with shelter and nourishment. 'Tis a mutually beneficial relationship, though I do wish they would refrain from peeling at mine bark so much.
Okay, that's good.
The last thing Boxy needed right now was to worry about authorities investigating this tree's interior because some people went missing.
What if they came into the dungeon portion of your body?
Then this one would ask them to leave, or force them to if they refused.
That's naive, Ambrosia,
it reprimanded her.
How so?
Dungeons are known to hold valuables and treasures. If word got out that your body had become home to one, it would lead to all sorts of greedy individuals attacking the dungeon in an attempt to plunder its riches. You wouldn't want that, right?
Heavens no, milord. Just the thought of that happening is extremely unpleasant. Then what doth milord suggest I do with such miscreants?
Capture them alive and prevent them from leaving here. You should be able to do that much without relying on prison management, yes?
'Tis so, milord. I can imprison them in cages made of mine roots and branches and sustain them with mine fruits for as long as need be. But what would that accomplish? Surely 'tis better to just kill them and use them as fertilizer, no?
That is also naive. The absence of certain people is sure to be noticed, which would mean those elves would send even more people to investigate their disappearance. the end result would be no different than simply letting them go.
Ah, thou speakest truly.
But worry not, for Snack and I are on your side. We'll be sure to handle those intruders in a way that will not draw attention to this place. If they're unimportant and will not be missed, they will be eaten. If they are regular citizens or people of importance, then we can tamper with their memory or cover up this place's existence in some other way.
I see. Milord's wisdom belies thy age. I shall engrave thy words unto mine heart, Wood.
Ambrosia took a deep bow while her emerald green eyes shone with respect. As expected, she was completely oblivious to the relationships between dungeons and adventurers, so Boxy wanted to make a good impression on her. It was insurance should the Dungeon Corps' influence weaken in the future. If the Dryad were to somehow reclaim her wits, then she would have memories of being treated as a partner rather than a slave. This would hopefully be enough to douse her ire when or if this occurred. Now that Boxy thought about it, why did dungeons exist in the first place? There were honestly very little benefits to the owner beyond making it a safe place to live. How come dungeons seemed to invite and tempt others into them? Was it because the vast majority of these places were apparently under the control of one god or another? Thinking back to the Litigar dungeon complex, that place was definitely made for the enjoyment of the goddess of improbabilities. The fact that she immediately contacted Boxy and offered to make it the dungeon master showed she actively kept an eye on things through the surveillance net. And yet, the spire of the Jade King was far less responsive, suggesting the place had not been of significance to its owner. It was therefore logical that owning a dungeon was not vital for these deities. Perhaps dungeons were simply a means to test the resolve and mettle of mortals? Something like, prove you are worthy and claim the power you deserve type of thing? It certainly seemed like the sort of thing a god or goddess would do. Well, one thing was for sure. Boxy would definitely not reward any invaders for breaking into its lair with the intent of robbing it blind. In fact, now that Fizzy would be seen as the dungeon's ally, it could fill the place with even more traps. It particularly looked forward to testing out those booby-trapped treasure chests it could build through trap management, not to mention the anti-flight countermeasures it had installed all over this chasm last night.
Arms, are you still busy cleaning out that termite nest?
It called out telepathically.
Hey, boss! And yeah, I am. It's taking longer than I thought, but I'm almost done.
Cora lacked Zira's wide area fire magic, so she was probably doing it by hand. Both her berserker and fiend jobs made her extremely well-suited to crushing little things in rapid succession. She was probably having a blast, especially since her violent meditation skill restored a tiny bit of her MP whenever she hit something, which allowed her to use her skills and martial arts a lot more often. And while she was scarily effective against many squishy targets, she was no less capable of taking down tough, armored opponents since she got her resonating blows skill. Using that, she could send destructive shockwaves that penetrated an opponent's defenses and ripped their insides to shreds. They were strong enough to rattle even Fizzy's highly durable mithril frame provided she actually got a good hit on her. That golem had gotten even better at avoiding, blocking, and parrying attacks than she was prior to becoming a golem. Her mithril frame was highly resistant to damage, but neither the paladin nor the shapeshifter wanted to see it scratched up, stained, or dented. On the whole, Boxy was superbly pleased with the progress of all of its minions, and its mood only soared further in anticipation of the evening's main event.
Meet me at the highest point of the dungeon with Nexus access when you're done, it commanded.
You got it, boss,
the fiend hollered back.
We're doing the thing tonight, right?
That's right.
Tonight was the night of a lunar convergence, during which all three of Terrania's moons would be visible in the sky. It was time to see whether this unholy wealth thing was all that it was cracked up to be. Not only was the result of the ritual of immense interest to the greedy monster, but performing it was also highly likely to earn Boxy the last chunk of demonology proficiency needed to hit level 8. This would, in turn, allow it to contract a third familiar. All in all, if things worked out as intended, Boxy's horde and... But first, it would have to do something about the yipping jewelry box currently running frantically between its legs. Part 4. Boxy stared inquisitively at the slightly hyperactive house mimic. The little guy had no idea what was going on, and seemed genuinely excited about its new owner's current chesty disposition. As for how it had gotten here, the shapeshifter remembered vaguely feeling something bump into its leg just as it had finished invoking the transfamiliar spell. It now realized that must have been Minnick, who had somehow hitched a ride, as it were. It then must have spent a few moments recovering from the spell's mildly disorienting effects before it started running around like an overstimulated puppy. The sequence of events baffled Boxy quite a bit, mostly because it had no idea that transfamiliar could be used to transport multiple living things at the same time. The thought had crossed its mind, but it had avoided testing it out for fear of what might happen to one or both parties. Still, it now had confirmation that using the spell in such a way was both possible and safe, which was sure to prove useful should such a thing become necessary in the future. A much more troubling thought crept into Boxy's mind. Both the monster and the dryad had completely failed to detect Minnick's presence. Admittedly, it had temporarily disabled the intruder alarm because of Fizzy, but surely the dungeon master would have seen it before it started yapping and running around. Even if not, she could clearly both see and hear it now, yet the dryad showed no reaction whatsoever.
"Ambrosia," it decided to ask, "why haven't you said anything about this creature?"
"What doth thy mean, my lord?"
the dumbfounded tree spirit replied.
"'Tis one of thy servants, is it not?"
"Well, it is, but shouldn't you be more concerned with a new intruder?"
"Hmm, thou art correct. 'Tis most bizarre now that I think of it. While this creature is undoubtedly an invader, I find myself unwilling to harm it. Almost as if... No, I am certain."
Ambrosia knelt down in front of Boxy and patted her thighs, prompting Minnick to stop whatever it was doing and leap into her lap with a few high-pitched yelps.
"This creature was definitely carved from mine timber,"
the dryad said with a gentle smile.
"Are you sure about that?"
"Absolutely,"
she insisted.
"'Tis difficult to put mine feelings into words, but I know for certain."
That would certainly explain her lack of animosity. Though the dungeon core exerted some amount of influence over the dryad, it did not control her most basic instincts. If Ambrosia saw Minnick as part of herself, or maybe even as an offspring of sorts, then it was only natural she would not want to hurt it. More importantly, her words also revealed the fact that the small mimic had a shell made out of actual wood rather than flesh disguised as wood. This seemed obvious now that Ambrosia pointed this out, yet Boxy had glossed over this despite having examined the critter's insides multiple times with its MLG. This bothered the shapeshifter. It felt as if it should have already noticed the fact that, now that it thought about it, Minnick seemed more like a box that had been brought to life rather than a life form disguised as a box. Admittedly, Boxy had more important things to worry about than its new pet's biology, but it couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. Perhaps the house mimic had some kind of skill that made it easier for the creature to avoid one's notice. The chest-shaped doppelganger then realized this was a good opportunity to test out a certain feature of the core's surveillance net. The module in question could perform an invader analysis, which seemed to be halfway between a basic appraisal and a full one. Though it wouldn't reveal skills or perks, it was still enough to gauge a living being's strength. Boxy hastily brought up the relevant screens and menus and activated the function in question. Minnick sensed something was going on and jumped out of Ambrosia's lap with a surprised,
"Yep!"
It calmed down a few seconds later. Once that was over, Boxy was left looking at a truly bizarre status screen. General information. Minnick. House Mimic. 462 years old. Servant of the household of Tol Saroth. Level 2 Doppelganger. Max. Level 2 Mimic. Max. Level 5 Demon Spawn. Max. 275 out of 275 HP, plus 0.5 per second. 0 out of 0 MP. Attributes. Strength, 25. Dexterity, 25. Agility, 25. Endurance, 50. Luck, 2048. One thing was abundantly clear. There was now zero doubt that this creature was one of Tol Saroth's original house mimics. Judging from this status, it had been created through some sort of fusion between a doppelganger and a demon. It was also quite a bit tougher than its appearance would suggest. However, the lack of intelligence and wisdom and that truly outrageous luck attribute hinted at an untellable tale of hardship. The fact this creature had survived for 4.5 centuries while being the living embodiment of dumb luck was incredible. The demonic energies that were used in its creation were also likely the cause of its unnatural longevity. Familiar's physical forms did not age, after all. Another thing that was obvious, Minik truly lacked the capacity of comprehending its surroundings as anything more complex than good things and bad things. This meant it was not actually a threat to its operation. Even if it somehow understood that Kira had a secret identity, it completely lacked the ability to communicate such a thing. It was physically incapable of spilling the beans. Not to mention that its bright red gem and lustrous golden trim made it uniquely shiny, which appealed greatly to Boxy's tastes. Ultimately, the doppelganger decided to keep the amusing little box, at least for the time being.
Ambrosia, can you keep Minik here company for a while?
It would be mine pleasure, milord.
She bent down and picked up the animate jewelry box, which immediately nuzzled itself between her breasts. Come to think of it, it did that a lot with Rowana and Leah, but not so much with Kira. This trend suggested that Minik, for whatever reason, seemed to prefer bustier women. Admittedly, it wasn't Boxy's place to fault another for their love of large chests, but that was clearly the wrong type of chest the former mimic had in mind. That aside, the important part was that Minik seemed content to sit tight rather than run around and interfere with Boxy's plans. Using Nexus Access, Boxy instantly transported itself to the highest point of the dungeon. It was still within the tree, so it used terrain sculpting to make its way out of it, much like before. It broke through the bark and found itself standing in the lush canopy of the hilt tree. The outrageously sized branches and leaves blocked out the view of the night sky. This was an issue, since the ritual Boxy wanted to perform required an unobstructed line of sight to all three moons. It therefore started climbing upwards, looking through the sea of branches and leaves for a suitable ritual site. It took several minutes until it found a relatively flat branch with a clear view of the night sky. Euidus, Leopra, and Tascuna, the three moons orbiting the world of Terrania, were the only things visible overhead. The moon's combined light was so intense that it completely drowned out the stars, as if they were intentionally hogging the celestial stage.
Boss, I'm done with the termites, came Cora's timely report. I'm on my way to... Ah, you're out of the dungeon. I can't get to you with Nexus Access. That's okay. I'll just resummon you.
Yes, this would cost a sizable chunk of MP, but it wasn't as if it had anything else to spend it on. After dismissing and recalling Cora to its side, it started recalling the steps and materials it would need to perform the long-anticipated unholy wealth ritual. It did so with a bit of apprehension, however, as it was once again reminded that it didn't know what the outcome would be. Yes, the demonology skill taught it all it needed to know to perform the ceremony, but that was it. Neither Arms nor Snack knew anything about it either, and Boxy hadn't been able to figure out how to research the topic as Kira without raising eyebrows. The only thing it could determine was that the ritual of unholy wealth would produce a magic item of some kind. How much harm could an inanimate object truly do? Its mind made up, Boxy opened its storage and started pulling out all of the ingredients and tools necessary for the ceremony. The more mundane materials consisted of a standard silver-plated mortar and pestle set, a small hammer, 5 gold coins, and a plain goblet carved out of oak. The rarer and subsequently more expensive ingredients included an elixir of avarice, a 6-centimeter-long mithril nail, an unprocessed midnight ruby, and a pure pearl that had been tainted by demonic essence. There was a bit of an issue with that last one, however. Boxy had obtained the component during its stay in Erosa, but the magical gemstone had reverted to its pure state over the long months it had sat inside the monster's storage. The shapeshifter was aware of this, which was why it needed Cora's assistance. It handed her the gemstone and told her to infuse it with her essence.
"Do what now?"
the fiend asked incredulously.
"Infuse it with your essence," it repeated. "How do I do that?" "It's like pumping mana into it as you would into a magic item."
"Oh.
You don't know how to do that either, do you?"
"Nope."
Boxy was briefly taken aback by this. Arms might not have been the shiniest coin in the purse, but it assumed she would know how to do something so basic. It realized now that was perhaps expecting too much from her, given how her only interaction she'd had with magic items thus far had been to break them. Still, it really wasn't that complex a technique, and if Boxy could pick it up as a mimic, then so could Arms. It just needed to think of a way to describe the process to her.
"Try to put it in your mouth, roll it around on your tongue, and think about it really hard. Oh, and careful not to bite down on it."
"Why does that sound like a blowjob?"
"Just do it."
"Yeah, yeah."
Cora took the snow-white pearl and did as instructed for several seconds before spitting it back out. She held the drool-covered gem up between her fingers, which was slightly darker in coloration than it used to be.
"This good enough?"
she asked expectantly.
"No, but it's a start. Keep going until I say otherwise."
While Arms got busy with that, Boxy grabbed the midnight ruby and started crushing it into dust using the mortar and pestle. The specially designed tool had some sort of effect on the gem and allowed the monster to grind up the dark red gemstone without any real difficulty. It was almost as if the precious stone crumbled on its own with the slightest push of the pestle. It still took 15 minutes to reduce it into the right consistency necessary for the ritual, though this was mostly because the monster was inexperienced with the tools it was using. Once it was satisfied with its handiwork, it carefully dumped the sparkling powder into the goblet, making extra sure the shiny dust didn't scatter in the wind.
"Arms, how are things going on your end?"
"Don't know. Let me see."
Cora spat out the once white pure pearl again, revealing that it was now completely black.
"This is good,"
declared Boxy, just before taking it from her. It briefly thought back on when it first obtained this reagent, wondering exactly why Snack had used her genitals to perform the act. Surely it was unnecessary, right? Well, it was an unimportant detail, so the monster brushed it off as Snack being Snack. Now that it had the re-corrupted pearl in its tentacles, it wiped off the spit, set it down on the wooden branch, and pressed the tip of the mithril nail into it. It then gripped the hammer with a third appendage and firmly tapped the nail's head several times. The pitch-black pearl was pierced and cracks spread through it. However, rather than fall apart like glass, it actually held itself together quite well. This was because this peculiar gemstone had a viscous goo-like substance within its tough outer shell. It was more like an egg of some kind, rather than a crystal bead. After confirming everything was going as expected, Boxy drove the mithril nail clean through the magical gemstone, puncturing it completely and causing the unidentifiable black liquid to drip out. Boxy hurriedly put the skewered pearl into the wooden goblet, where its juices slowly began mixing with the pulverized midnight ruby. The monster then arranged the 5 gold coins into a small pentagon and placed the simple cup in the middle of it. Finally, it reached over and grabbed the bottle of elixir of avarice it had bought off an alchemist back in Erosa. This orange-colored magic potion supposedly allowed its user to literally sniff out any and all gold within 15 meters, and its effects lasted for a full day. Boxy didn't need this silly thing for itself, since its magical perception was already more than capable of doing that, so it poured the contents of the bottle into the wooden goblet without hesitation. The orange-tinted liquid was quickly dyed blood red by the powdered midnight ruby and started hissing ominously. The punctured pearl floated just beneath the surface of the concoction, despite it being way too heavy to do so under normal circumstances. Boxy shifted back into its Chester Underwood persona for a moment, as the ritual required a humanoid appearance to complete successfully. It wasn't sure why it chose this shape in particular, though it didn't really care either way. Once the ritual site was set up, it deftly grabbed the mithril nail sticking out of the floating pearl and began slowly stirring the mixture and chanting,
"Suspendisse vitae maximus augue, eget porta ante, nella eget justo facilisis, sagittes massain, eus mod leo."
The fraudulent elf's voice carried clearly through the otherwise quiet night. It was a good thing there was nobody who lived within almost a kilometer of its current position, otherwise they would have surely noticed what was about to happen.
"Curabitur hendrarit libero quis mi finibus, e venenatis nece tinsidunt, pelentesque eliefend effesitur pulvinar."
The pure white metal nail and pitch-black pearl both turned a deep crimson as they soaked up part of the liquid they floated in.
"Enien hendrerit dictum maximus."
Boxy let go of the skewered jewel, which continued to make circular motions as if guided by an invisible hand, and then stood up from its kneeling position.
"Suspendisse potenti iuitis, suspendisse potenti leopra, suspendisse potenti tascuna."
It lifted its head and arms towards the sky while shouting, as if begging each of the moons for a favor in turn.
"Crasiget moris volputate, bibendam sem sitam et elementum felis."
The 5 gold coins started vibrating and glowing with a bright yellow light while the skewered pearl levitated a few centimeters into the air. It had absorbed all of the liquid from the goblet and glowed an intense bright red.
"Unc metas ulam corpor libero, quis bibendum tortor urna nec orci."
Boxy felt the hair on its head stand on end along with an odd sense of dread. The monster yelled out the last 2 words of the chant before it could process the significance of this peculiar sensation.
"Divitius illego perpequitum."
A bolt of golden lightning struck the wooden goblet despite the total absence of clouds. The unexpected occurrence made Boxy blurt out a weird noise while reflexively backing away. The shapeshifter nearly fell off the branch in its panic and had to shift back into its spider-legged, chesty form to cling onto it.
"Boss, you okay down there?"
Cora shouted from above.
"Nobody told me there would be lightning involved,"
Boxy yelled in frustration.
"I'll die for sure if I get hit by that. Seriously, what the crap? Why do these stupid rituals always try to kill me?"
The monster let off a rather uncharacteristic string of complaints as it climbed up the side of the branch, back to where it was mere moments prior.
"I think that's sort of the point, boss,"
Cora smirked mockingly. Her master graciously ignored her unflattering tone and directed its attention towards the place that mystical bolt of lightning had struck. The sturdy iron-bark-covered branch was charred black, a testament to that thunderbolt's power. The wooden goblet, gold coins, and thoroughly expensive mixture had fused together into a solid gold cup that was shiny beyond belief. A row of glowing red runes was etched alongside its rim, while intricate golden carvings covered the rest of the vessel. The pattern swirled, swiveled, and wrapped around its surface seemingly at random with no beginning or end. A total of 12 red, opal-shaped gems were evenly spaced out around its shining surface. The inside of the goblet was coated by an off-white metal with a slight green hue to it. It held a dark red liquid oddly reminiscent of blood in its coloration and consistency. This item's name, although unknown to Boxy at the time, was Profanus Gloria. The shapeshifter stared intently, feeling a rather ominous aura coming from the object.
"Arms, does that shiny thing look cursed to you?"
Cora took a few steps forward and crouched down to get a better look, her face slowly twisting in confusion.
No idea. Sorry, boss. This mystical stuff is more the cock gobbler's thing."
"I see.
Boxy was more or less convinced there was a curse, as the magic oozing from it was foul and thoroughly untasty. It was very similar to how Fizzy's gauntlet used to be prior to her fusing with it. Although the curse had weakened severely since then, the sensation it gave off at the time was almost identical to the one coming from the goblet. It was the almost part that gave Boxy pause. Looking closer, it appeared that the source of the curse was not the goblet itself, but the strange liquid it held. As the creature got closer, it found itself overcome with a very peculiar urge to drink the stuff in one go. That was clearly a bad idea, and yet part of it still wanted to do it. It craved it.
Boss?
Cora piped, then swallowed audibly.
Can I get a sip of that?
It would appear that the fiend was no less influenced by this thing. This was a good opportunity to test its effects, so the monster would allow her to—
No, it's mine!
It shouted. The fiend's face grew twisted with rage when she heard that. It was a good thing the contract was in place, otherwise Boxy would definitely have been attacked right now. The worst part of this scenario, however, was that those words were not its own.
This delicious thing is all mine, I tell you!
It was extremely strange. No matter how much it tried to speak its mind, the wrong words kept coming out. Almost as if someone or something else put those sentences into its mouth. It was probably some strange